So, about healthcare. Let's, for today anyway, let's just not, shall we? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Con Rosenthal. Thursday, the 20th of July, 2017. Glad, as always, to have you along. As the Senate keeps, John, trying to figure out what it is going to do about that subject that, for today anyway, on this broadcast shall not be named, it is helpful to remember that there are other big economic policy issues to deal with. House Speaker Paul Ryan was in Lawrence, Massachusetts today talking tax reform. The White House says it's held, quote, hundreds of listening sessions on taxes. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Gary Cohn of the National Economic Council have been meeting behind closed doors with CEOs and tax policy experts. But as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, reaching consensus on the size and shape of tax reform, much like healthcare, is proving difficult as well.
With efforts to reshape healthcare looking more doubtful by the day, Republican leadership needs a win on tax reform big time. To get one, the GOP will need the support of groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which has been meeting with the administration to discuss priorities.
It gives us a chance to give input into what we want to see or what we need and the American business community needs from pro-growth tax reform.
Caroline Harris is vice president of tax policy for the chamber.
Let's learn from the healthcare process and avoid some of those pitfalls so we can get this over the finish line.
Harris says that includes being open to compromise if necessary, but others feel taxes will be an easier lift than healthcare. Grover Norquist is an anti-tax activist and president of Americans for Tax Reform.
There's no natural opposition to a tax cut. There's no specific lobby with its claws into a congressman screaming, don't cut taxes.
But others claim the same all-or-nothing attitude that scuttled healthcare is now showing up with taxes. Essentially, the GOP wants everything with tax reform, deep cuts, revenue neutral, the whole shebang. Laura Blessing is with the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown.
They're not trying for the easier lift.
There may be some fallback options, but we don't know yet because Republicans still haven't released their tax overhaul blueprint. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Wages and the lack of growth thereof, as we have been telling you every month in the unemployment reports for what feels like forever, are right up at the top of the list of big drags on this economy. But there's a new report out from the Labor Department called Usual Weekly Earnings of Wage and Salary Workers that shows median earnings up 4.2% compared to a year ago. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, that is good news for people at the bottom of the pay scale.
In Bend, Oregon, the local economy's booming with tech and tourism and home building. Unemployment's down to 3.5%, and employers are struggling to find the workers they need. Greg Lambert runs a local staffing agency.
One of our clients in manufacturing this week told us we could raise our pay rates by $3 an hour.
That's for low-skilled factory work. And it's the kind of solid wage growth that we're seeing in recent Labor Department data on weekly take-home pay, up more than 4% year over year. University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson says prices are only going up about half as fast.
That means people have more purchasing power.
And after years of anemic wage gains, the bottom tenth of wage earners are sharing the gains. Workers are in demand in sectors like hospitality and construction that often don't require more than a high school education.
As the labor market tightens, it's not just that wages per hour are going to go up, but people are going to be offered more hours at work. They're going to be offered more overtime.
Minimum wage hikes in cities and states across the country kicked in this year, which is also driving pay higher. Aparna Mathur at the American Enterprise Institute says that could ultimately be a problem if employers can't afford to hire younger, lower-skilled workers.
You know, I worry that in the long run, the employment gains will not be sustained.
But for now, Joseph Bruzuelas at consulting firm RSM says employers his firm has surveyed are ready to offer perks as well as higher salaries.
Over a quarter of our respondents indicated that they were expected to put a premium on top of that wage increase in order to attract and retain workers.
Premiums like richer benefits and higher company contributions to employee retirement plans. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, steady as she goes. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Markets stumbled for a very quick second today on some news from Bloomberg that Robert Mueller, the special counsel looking into Russian interference in last year's campaign, has expanded his inquiry into the president's business dealings. Perhaps no single part of the Trump Organization, which, remember, the president has stepped back from day-to-day operations of, but has not put into a blind trust. Perhaps no single part of that company has gotten more attention than his new hotel, a couple of blocks from the White House. The standard story about the Trump International Hotel in Washington is about something called the Emoluments Clause and whether the president is violating the Constitution. This story is not that Trump Hotel story. This is the one about how that hotel has become a magnet for the powerful and the curious in that city and how that is giving the rest of Washington's luxury hotel businesses some heartburn. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer is on it.
The Trump International Hotel, just four blocks from the White House, is pure Trump. Grand, gaudy, nine-story atrium, gold, marble, and crystal everywhere. Some of Washington's top power brokers are often on display, too. Lawrence Bruckner got a glimpse of one. Bruckner's a Trump supporter from Thompson, Illinois.
There were some wonderful people there in the chandeliers, and we had a senator sitting beside us there.
I caught up with Bruckner outside the Trump Hotel after lunch. He didn't come here for the $61 Dover sole and soy brown butter with capers, or the $140 crystal spoonful of Hungarian wine. Like everyone else I spoke to, he was drawn to the hotel by the celebrity of Trump. And that's a problem for the attorneys general of Maryland and the District of Columbia. They filed suit against the president. Carl Racine is the attorney general for D.C.
The president's hotel, by virtue of it being the president's business, provides an unfair playing field to his business over that of other competing businesses.
Racine cites an example. He says the embassy of Kuwait moved an event from the Four Seasons Hotel to the Trump Hotel. And he says the Trump Hotel may be taking business away from other hotels and city-owned facilities, including the convention center. Experts who follow the hotel and convention business, like Haywood Sanders at the University of Texas at San Antonio, say the celebrity of the Trump Hotel notwithstanding,
it's a pretty modestly sized hotel in a very large hotel market.
To be more specific,
the Trump Hotel has 263 rooms in a city hotel market that has over 31,000 hotel rooms available.
A market that just happens to be one of the strongest in the country right now. People flock to D.C. in the first half of this year, starting with President Trump's inauguration and the protests that followed. Sanders says the average room rate for D.C.'s downtown core was $242 a night last year. Average room rates for this year aren't available yet, but
in 2017, we're really doing well.
That's Elliot Ferguson, the president and CEO of Destination DC, the DC Convention and Visitors Bureau. He says the market is strong enough that there are 16 more hotels in the pipeline. That means everybody who's already in the game is doing what they can to stand out in the crowd.
They're going to employ every single option to remain competitive. And sometimes that does not necessarily mean reducing your rate, and other times it might.
That rate, by the way, can easily top $600 a night at luxury hotels like the Four Seasons, the Willard Intercontinental, and the Trump Hotel. No one's complaining about losing customers to the Trump Hotel, at least publicly. Business is one thing. Dissing the president is something else. D.C. Attorney General Racine says, legally, it doesn't matter how much of an advantage the Trump Hotel might have over a competitor.
So long as it's adversely impacted in a manner that is unfair, that makes the level playing field not fair and just, that's enough.
Even though sometimes the Trump name is a disadvantage. Back at the Trump Hotel, Mike Olson, a healthcare executive from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, tells me he went to a business dinner here recently.
I had the sea bass. And it was okay at best.
Olson says as far as staying at the hotel, not likely.
I hope Trump does very well. I hope he's a successful president, but I just have some trouble at this point supporting his businesses.
At this point, that's not a problem. He's got options, 31,000 of them. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Got milk? You know, probably, arguably, the dairy industry's best ad slogan ever. How about got cheese? That do anything for you? Americans are eating record amounts of cheese, but dairy farmers still have plenty of the base product, milk, of course, left over. Enter then Dairy Management Incorporated, a quasi-government trade group whose mission is to find a use for all that extra milk, cheese, and butter. Enter also the fast food chain Taco Bell. Clint Rennie wrote about him from Bloomberg Business Week. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me, would you, first of all, about dairy in America. We are making oh so much cheese, butter, and milk.
Cheese in particular has really been taking off. It was at about 15 pounds per person in the 70s, and it has more than doubled. It's now up to 35 pounds average amount per person per year, which, you know, breaks down to about a pound and a half a week.
Wow.
Interestingly, though, a lot of the other dairy has not been doing quite as well. Milk in particular has done the exact opposite of cheese. They're churning out a whole lot more milk than they ever have in the past, and now the farmers have to find something to do with it. They have an oversupply, and so they've been literally dumping it into the ground.
That milk-cheese divide, which I think is the first time that phrase has ever been used on this program, it is not just happenstance. I mean, there is an active effort to get Americans to eat more cheese.
Exactly. I think that the industry realized that cheese basically sells itself, although it could do a lot better if it had a little, I guess let's call it a gray eminence, working behind the scenes to encourage more sales. And that's exactly what Dairy Management Inc. does.
Well, tell me about them. You call them the Illuminati of cheese. Tell me about that.
They are effectively a marketing creation of the USDA. They do get a little bit of our tax dollars, but the bulk of their budgets actually come from the producers. So the farmers and producers pay 15 cents for every 100 pounds of dairy that they sell.
Huh. The through line of this piece is the Dairy Management Group actually sending people into Taco Bell, right, to help them create and invent and perfect the quesalupa.
This quesalupa was an item that Taco Bell had been trying to develop for about a decade. And so for them to feel like they needed to bring in a PhD chemist to find a way to create this item, they had tried a lot of things, some of them more hilarious than others. They at one point effectively just folded a quesadilla in half, and consumers weren't terribly pleased with that. I think the word that was used was lame. But
that's a technical marketing term.
Yeah, so that one kind of flopped, and then they just kind of went back to the basics. They took shredded cheese and they stuck it in the middle of two tortillas and just closed the sides off and then deep fried it, of course.
Of course. Taco Bell is not alone in its cheesiness. Almost all the other big fast food brands are going heavy into cheese because Americans like to eat cheese.
Yeah, exactly. I think if you want to look for sort of an impetus for dairy management's movement into all of these other companies as well, it was Pizza Hut back in the 90s when the stuffed crust pizza came out. That was effectively their first partnership that they did with a fast food company, and people loved it. And in fact, they made $300 million more dollars that year just from selling stuffed crust pizza.
A word here about caloric intake, because, you know, cheese is good and gooey and all that jazz, but it doesn't do much for your waistline.
Yeah, lots of saturated fat, lots of cholesterol, and that's been one of the big complaints that DMI has had against its promotional efforts. They have responded to the criticism, I think, as best as they can, but I mean, at root, cheese is just cheese, and one of the reasons I think people love it so much is because of the fat content.
Mm-hmm. Clint Rennie contributes to Bloomberg Business Week. His piece is called "The Mad Cheese Scientists Fighting to Save the Dairy Industry." Clint, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up.
It was the only option, really, unless you wanted to fish and hunt for a living.
When the biggest economic game in town is bad for your environmental health. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 28 points this Thursday, a tenth percent, 21,611. The NASDAQ nudged up 4 points, less than a tenth percent, 6390. S&P 500 doing nothing, barely changed, 2473. Not often I've said this recently, but traders were all over Sears stock today. Yes, Sears. The company said it's going to be selling its Kenmore brand appliances on Amazon, synced up with Amazon's Alexa. That got top reviews from investors, pushed shares up 10.5% today. Home Depot shares got caught in the backwash, though, amid worries its appliance sales are going to be hit, down 4% there. Energy provider Avista supplies a lot of the Northwest, got a power boost today. Announced it's being bought by a Canadian company called Hydro One for $5 billion and change. Avista shares up 20% on that news. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. One of President Trump's stated priorities, along with health care and, as we set up at the top of the program, taxes, is an infrastructure program. So far, all the detail we have on that is a proposal to privatize the air traffic control system in this country. But in China, they're taking infrastructure and their trading relationships and rolling them into one big package. It's a huge railroad and infrastructure program called the New Silk Road. It'll follow generally the historic trading route of the same name and beyond, China to the UK in this case. Beijing is going to spend $1 trillion to get the thing done. The BBC's China editor, Carrie Gracie, is traveling some 7,000 miles along that route and reports today from Kazakhstan in Central Asia.
It's tough building the project of the century under a burning sun. Pinhead flies are gathering on Xu Xiwen's white shirt, and he's sweating under his hard hat. But his mind is already fixed on winter, when the temperature here falls to minus 40.
We have to stay calm or we can't get the job done. There's no need to panic.
Xu Xiwen is building the stations for an urban light railway in Kazakhstan's capital, Astana. So far, this station is just a few holes in the ground. But he's a veteran of can-do Chinese construction. Impossible deadlines usually met.
I do feel the pressure. We all feel it. I hope it'll spur us on. And we need to work as a team. Without sticking together, a plate of loose sand can't form a fist.
No wonder he feels the pressure. The promotional video for the urban railway features the Chinese president. The new Silk Road is Xi Jinping's big idea. What's noticeable is that so much of this project is Chinese, not Kazakh. The equipment, the funding, the design, the majority of the jobs. In fact, Xu Xiwen is wary of tensions with the locals.
Our canteens and dorm areas will be separate so we don't disturb each other. For a big Chinese team like this, we'll bring our own chefs and cook Chinese food.
It's easy to see how China benefits from this new Silk Road. It'll get jobs and business in the short term, and it'll earn interest on its loans for decades to come. But what about Kazakhstan? A shiny urban railway is a nice thing to have, but is it what Kazakhs need most? I'm here in the village of Kenkiak because it sits on top of a valuable oil field. And that oil field is run by China's state-owned oil giant, CNPC. One kindergarten here has been turned into a hostel for Chinese workers. And the village children are clamouring about on rubble because they've got no playground. The air smells chemical, the houses are mostly derelict, and the streets more pothole than road. Ardak Kubisheva was once a teacher at the village school. She's begged the Chinese oil company to do more for the local community.
The Chinese have done nothing. There's such a huge oil industry here, but still no jobs or facilities for young people.
Government intimidation makes many Kazakhs afraid of speaking up like Ardak. But privately, several villagers tell me they agree with her. They complain that Chinese companies pay bribes to bend the rules. China says its presence abroad is a win-win. But here in Kenkiak, they say that means China wins once, and then it wins again. On the other side of Kazakhstan, Xu Xiwen hopes his urban railway will be a win for China and a win for the people in its path. It certainly needs to be, if the new Silk Road is going to build the big, harmonious family that the Chinese president has promised.
That was the BBC's China editor, Carrie Gracie, reporting for us in Kazakhstan. It's been a while since we've talked about carbon footprints on the program, but we have got a doozy today. Carbon footprints being how much carbon, how much greenhouse gas, of course, this activity or that puts into the atmosphere. The number one greenhouse gas emitter in this country is a coal-fired power plant in West Jefferson, Alabama. So says the most recent data from the Environmental Protection Agency. It's got the same climate impact as 4 million cars do in a year. But as Gigi Duban reports, for a lot of people who live nearby, that plant is an economic necessity.
If you're driving around the town of West Jefferson looking for a place to eat, you won't find much. On a recent afternoon, I tried to find Alabama Rose, a restaurant that popped up in a search on my phone. Turns out the restaurant burned down a few years ago, but it's still where 78-year-old Arthur Graves lives. He opens a beer and shows me what's left of the restaurant.
We had a steam table here, and that was the kitchen back there where the chimney is.
3 decades ago, Graves bought the restaurant and the house next door on his salary from Alabama Power, which owns the Miller Power Plant. It's 3 miles away across the Warrior River. He retired as a boiler operator, making $20 an hour. It was a good way to make a living, he says. And in West Jefferson?
It was the only option, really, unless you wanted to fish and hunt for a living.
Graves' son and nephew went on to work for the power plant, and he still depends on it for his income.
I draw a pension from the power company, and my relatives and I and a lot of us depend. We would not want to see the power company in trouble.
The Center for Public Integrity recently analyzed EPA data that showed Miller to be the top polluter for greenhouse gas emissions in the country, 19 million metric tons a year. That's based on information the company filed with the EPA. Jamie Smith Hopkins is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. She says people care about things that affect their jobs or their health now, not the long-term consequences of carbon emissions.
It's not something that you can necessarily see in the same way that you can see the economic impact, which is, you know, really important on a day-to-day basis.
Industrial sites that emit greenhouse gases tend to also put out other types of air pollution. Federal regulations have prompted Alabama Power to curb some of those toxic emissions. Michael Schneiderman is a spokesman for Alabama Power.
At Plant Miller, we've made close to $1.4 billion in investments related to meeting environmental regulations.
Those regulations cover air pollutants like sulfur dioxide and mercury, which the plant has reduced significantly over the past decade. But in March, President Donald Trump signed an executive order reversing the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, which aimed to cut greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants.
And one thing you don't want to do is spend tens of millions or hundreds of millions or more trying to essentially meet a target that does not exist.
Climate change isn't something that worries people I spoke with in West Jefferson. Take Bobby Beckman. He owns the West Jefferson convenience store.
If something does happen to this planet, I won't be around to see it.
Beckman says his business thrives on plant workers who come in daily to buy food and beer and cigarettes. He also rents furnished units for outside contractors who work at Miller. He lives 3 minutes from the Miller plant, and he says he has no health issues.
There's a dust issue, but, you know, you've got a lot of things that contribute to that. You know, you do have Miller steam plant. You have railroad tracks not far from here. You have coal trucks running up and down the road.
But he says that's okay. Everyone's got to make a living somehow. In West Jefferson, Alabama, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, one more item on President Trump's business practices. You might have seen that on Monday, the White House increased by 15,000 the number of visas authorized for foreign seasonal workers in this economy. H-2B is the official designation. Today, according to the Department of Labor, the president's resort at Mar-a-Lago filed for permission to hire 70 foreign workers because they couldn't find enough American citizens to take the jobs. Cooks, housekeepers, and restaurant servers, pay scale is $10.33 to $13.34 an hour. All right, we're out of here. The Dow down 28 today, about a 10%. NASDAQ up 4, less than a 10th. S&P 500 didn't do bupkis. John Buckley, Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I figure I'll give him a pass today. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.